Sex in the Workplace. It's not a TV sequel to Sex in the City. It's a global pandemic that affects the groin area, not the lungs, and has been around since the dawn of employment. Inappropriate touching and commentary are one thing. Rape and coercive sexual conduct are the fat, horrible monster on the other side of this seesaw. The hashtag MeToo movement empowered women and trans workforce members to share their stories. But many are saying that's still not enough to change inappropriate sexual behavior in the workforce. Now a new company, well, it's not that new anymore, stands to eliminate sexual desire entirely and thus minimize and eventually stamp out inappropriate sexual conduct. They're taking gas-guzzling sex drive and its carbon cockprint and turning it into a no-gas, sex-neutral shadow that doesn't give anyone the willies. Don't go for a tumescent jog. Sit back and relax. You're listening to Flog. Hello and welcome to Flog. I'm your top flog and host, Seetal Singhil. That's a very sexual name, Flog. Is it? I can safely say that's news to me, as I had hoped this podcast would help me pick up women, but sadly, it has not.
That would be an inappropriate use of intellectual property.
That's true. At Flog, when we speak to entrepreneurs like yourself, we like to get to the 5% of ourselves we cannot share with others. So I just delve deep to share a fact about myself on the podcast I often wouldn't share with just anyone.
I mean, barriers to sharing, particularly about sexual choices, is exactly what my company stands for. So that was a bad start. Unless you said it to immediately allow me to correct you and thus demonstrate the core values I hold and that are deeply embedded with my company. I mean, if you meant to do that, that I could understand.
You're too smart for me. Anyway, I want to robustly introduce you. So do I have your consent to do that?
Yeah, I grant you my consent.
Great news. Jamiroquan Kanhai. That's my guest today. He started his career as an activist, fundraising and educating around the poor wages and employment treatment of women in his native British Guyana, as well as other countries nearby in South America, such as Suriname and Venezuela. He then graduated with a law degree from Stanford and finished a PhD there on sexual behaviour in the workplace, focusing on analysing sexual harassment, as well as other undesirable behaviours and potential solutions to those behaviours. He also researched and popularised ideas which would formulate his entrepreneurial direction. In 2016, he formed a small company called Libidno, pronounced as such, which espoused the philosophy of asexuality in the workplace. Not sexuality, asexuality, as a way of changing the role of sexuality in the workplace and actively combating the slew of sexual misconduct situations in American work settings. And it went from a niche consultancy business to now offering numerous products and services with Forbes of the magazine fame, valuing it at $74 million last year, because this is a company with 200 plus corporate clients reporting a 79% reduction in established complaints and interventions around sexually inappropriate behavior. Now, Libidno has set up an office in Sydney to provide services to Australian businesses and workers. Finally, welcome to Flog, Jamiroquan Kanhai.
Thank you for having me.
From the outset, tell us why you formed Libidno in the first place.
As you say, I've been an activist since my early teens. In Guyana, my situation was very close to the poverty line. My father died when I was six. I was raised by my mother and her two elder sisters, my aunts. Even as a teenager, I was very aware of the patriarchy as this impractical, often sinister force. I was the only man in a house of 11 people, and the importance I was given as a teenager within society seemed ludicrous, given the wisdom and intelligence of the women that were raising me. My mother and her sisters all worked in textile production, and all of them had employers that were dishonorable men, all married, all reputedly good Hindu men or Christian men, and all having affairs with multiple employees.
That sort of behavior is pretty common in the Caribbean, as well as the subcontinent and its colonies even today, isn't it?
Unfortunately, yes it is. I don't feel any anger or shame towards my mother or my aunties, because shame is often what results as a prevailing feeling of women who are taken advantage of by their employers.
Shame is a really problematic emotion. I believe Gandhi said shame was like fame, but with more
Exactly. So when I had the opportunity to study law, I was naturally drawn to workplace law or the case studies. Were really interesting, and I was curious how supposedly more liberal environment like America would be in its workplaces.
Where were you working when you reached America?
I worked at the chain restaurant Juggies.
Right, that's Juggies. That Juggies, with the pretty girls, the competitor to Hooters. You weren't mucking around in taking that job, were you? You went straight to one of the most controversial workplaces around.
Well, yes and no. I think, Juggies and Hooters, but Juggies is a great example of a deeply flawed and hypocritical premise, which is that a workplace that jokes around the topic of female breasts being one of the hooks to pay for overpriced meals then has the temerity to market itself as a family restaurant. So I had to understand beyond the simplicity of his premise that what sat underneath the problems that emerged for the Juggies girls needing to wield the weaponry of their cleavage to make an income. I mean, that's what would enable a career advancement.
I'll play devil's advocate here. Is there a hypocrisy in Juggies and the way it presents itself? After all, families. I'll play devil's advocate here. Is there really a hypocrisy in Juggies and the way it presents itself? After all, families, most of them, have breasts involved. They're pretty critical to the formation of a family, if not, in fact, its maintenance.
Family values, at least the conservative concept of family values in the Christian tradition of America, do not generally welcome the sexualizing of teenagers. I think we can agree on that. So your argument there is asinine.
Well, it's not my argument, it's the devil's argument. I'm just advocating it, hence devil's advocate.
Nonetheless, it's a deliberately hypocritical marketing ploy to sexualize girls in their early 20s to cater to a largely male heterosexual clientele and then hanging under the banner of family dining.
So let's say a man takes his family there. I imagine a wife with her kids, in proximity to a 21-year-old blonde named Sunday, who's one of the Juggies girls. This mother, let's call her Carla. Carla's judging Sunday. She's probably thinking, don't be so obvious, Sunday. Wow, what a great set of breasts. What a poor girl having this cruddy job, poor Sunday. But also thinking, I wish I looked like that again to have my husband's attention, like he's currently dedicating to this little hussy who's got the same name as Day of the Week. Now, I bet there are other scenarios in Carla's life where she is thinking and feeling similar thoughts, in which case Juggies does a good job of recreating the confused sexual dynamics and motion and emotion of jealousy, disappointment, and longing that otherwise underpin a typical family dynamic in America.
That is quite a hypothetical.
Absolutely.
Because there's a lot of detail in there. It's like a hypothetical. You know, with that ER.
Well, at Flog, we go hard. Not in the sexual way, obviously. Well, not mid-podcast. So I like the idea that I'm hyper-ER-thetical. ER, as in, if I put more effort into this theoretical scenario I just painted for you with Carla and Sunday, I'm so hyper, I could end up in the ER.
Let's take your premise at face value. The family unit is under threat from desire in society. So Juggies is a microcosm of society and that threat. That's not something for a restaurant to aspire to. If restaurants are to replicate and mirror societal failings, if that mirroring is part of their function, we would see more murders in restaurants as an expected pleasure of attendance thereof.
A pleasure? Well, look, I've been in a restaurant when a man was murdered. Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah, well, when he was murdered, I did value my experience more for not being murdered. I mean, I was alive, and it was pizza, so I was enjoying that.
Right.
And for having finished my main, so that I ate well, but then I didn't feel like I had the appetite for dessert. Because murder does not push a man to want a tiramisu or a panna cotta. or should I say murder and a pizza, does not push a man to want a tiramisu or a panna cotta. Now, speaking of delicious desserts, juggies generally had personal considered more delicious than the food. Is that okay to say?
Actually, it's not okay to say that, as it's inappropriately characterizing the girls working there as edible consumables.
Okay, good to know. I've known some girls who've worked at juggies, although not biblically.
They haven't biblically worked at juggies?
No, I haven't biblically known them. Anyway, they say that juggies as a work environment taught them to feel more confident with their bodies and socialize with a wide variety of people. Do you see their point? Do you see these girls' point?
I can see that for younger women who feel the societal unreasonable pressure to conform to sexual ideals would kowtow to those pressures elegantly in their own eyes in the setting of a juggies, because they're going to try their best. However, there are more appropriate settings for that.
Well, you are known for your excellent statistical work. In fact, Libidno's internal research is second to none on workplace sexual dynamics. Jamira Kang, you're practically the Kinsey of all jobs. Kinsey, of course, the great sexual researcher during the 50s and 60s.
He's a role model of mine.
And he was an expert in understanding all sexual activity, but I guess he only covered certain jobs of the blow, hand, nose, foot variety. You cover all jobs, except probably for actually the jobs I just named, ironically.
He did sparse research in workplace sexual dynamics. But I have to say my work has far surpassed his. Now you want the statistics on the juggies workplace. Presumably you want something that's based on what you were saying about it being a positive environment for the waitresses.
The ones with the tight tops and the short shorts. Those waitresses? Yeah, they're who I was asking about.
I can tell you that female staff in one of my original surveys working at juggies reported an 8.1 out of 10 satisfaction survey overall with their work at the location I worked at near Stanford.
That's good, isn't it?
That statistic is yes. However, further closer analysis showed that sexual harassment complaints from the owner or management inappropriately touching or speaking to the girls was 35% of the girls there. 35%.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's less appealing, I'd have to say.
Now, Miss Juggie's swimsuit pageant were the greatest source of morale and perceived career advancement in that group. However, they fired three girls just in that year, the same girls that got fired were subjected to inappropriate conduct. I mean, that was indicative of the problems with that entire workplace model.
So you picked a controversial workplace, but your thesis in Stanford broadened to more workplaces across California.
And into Oregon as well, that's correct. The thesis looked at 300 different workplaces and I wanted no more than 5 in any industry for basic like-for-like comparisons only. But I didn't want to skew it too much towards a particular industry.
So talk us through the findings in this thesis you did, because it really is the basis for Libidno's creation. The key take home from my reading of it was that sexual feelings in the workplace are one issue, but feelings of libido while working are another issue.
So my key finding was around sexual feelings in the workplace. 92% of all males surveyed had sexual feelings in the workplace, compared with 42% of all the females. Again, you rely on these studies on the honesty of the participants surveyed, counting on their honesty or their opinion. Now, those males, 30% admitted to having romantic or sexual interactions with women that they worked with. That was anything from kissing a workmate at a Christmas party to having sex in a janitorial closet to a date with a work colleague.
Did you look only at people who had regular contact with a coworker? I can, like, regular day-to-day contact. I can imagine if I'm working for a large bank and I date someone in the legal department when I'm a bank teller at the coalface, that is basically like dating somebody from a different business.
I separated that out, of course. You know, that can skew the figures. So we do ongoing research at Libidno to prevent skewed figures. Getting back to the findings, though, we had 12% of those males surveyed as saying that they had been involved in or accused of some form of sexual misconduct. With female respondents, though, 70% listed some form of sexual harassment with having been experienced, and 15% reported having escalated their discomfort to a form of complaints of harassment or worse. Police were involved in actually 3% of the cases.
Right. Nah, those are pretty high figures. They don't paint a pretty picture of workplace dynamics.
No, so we looked at the company or business or team performance versus prevalence of sexual awareness. And we looked at that against cases of sexual complaint, i.e., you know, somebody is sexually aware that they have been harassed versus actually formalizing it as a complaint. So the respondent survey reply statistics versus the formal complaints made within a workplace was really what we were focusing on for the study. It was very clear that workplaces with employees who less frequently expressed sexual feelings in the workplace had more successful companies, while those who had sexual feelings in the workplace easily expressed and commonly seen did not perform as well. Looking at EBITDA, earnings before interest and tax, and revenue growth as the two key indicators of success. So my conclusion around this was that if we could minimize sexuality in the workplace, that would lead to performance enhancement.
I'm struck by the irony of hearing the words performance enhancement and knowing you don't mean sexual performance. That, in fact, performance enhancement is directly, inversely correlative to sex.
Great performance in work can lead to the kind of prosperity and confidence that sets the stage for truly off-work sex. And off-work sex, or, you know, sans work sex, that's important. So, you know, great performance in work can lead to the kind of prosperity and confidence that sets the stage for truly off-work sex. That much I firmly believe.
Even though you're asexual.
Anecdotally, that's what I believe, yes.
Now, your studies about sexual feelings, not necessarily in the workplace, but related to work, I thought was very telling, particularly as people working from home. We will have listeners saying, I go to work. I've never dated a coworker. I've never even gotten a stiffy over a line manager. I don't know that I'd ever need libido. They're not relevant to me. But it's this idea of opportunity cost that's relevant to all of us, isn't it? Opportunity cost.
Yes, well, we surveyed people who took work home as we were interested in the effect of sexual feelings on productivity. We brought in the research recently to survey people looking to set up new businesses, to become entrepreneurial, in other words, and study the effects of their sexual behavior on the pursuit of completing work outside of normally prescribed hours, or looking at project-based workers, or budding entrepreneurs. These studies indicated something really profound, that sexual feeling got in the way of work.
That adds up. I think of people with a dream, aiming to change the world, a big, hairy, audacious goal, which is plump and nubile like a vulva or a scrotum. And I see these people focusing on that, getting sidetracked with masturbation, and I think to myself, yes, this story checks out.
Work-inspired masturbation, yeah, it's a problem. Now, what this meant is you might have the idea to build a business plan, to set up a brand new business. You have no hard deadline on this. Entrepreneurs only prescribe their own deadlines. What often occurs is that something about the idea or the work would mix with sexual feelings, and instead of the business plan being written, we had a delay or more often outright failure to produce any meaningful work, because the so-called entrepreneur spent that time masturbating.
So instead of a business plan, after 3 days, you might have 7 semeny ejaculations and assuming 3 tissues to deal with each ejaculation. You had 21 used tissues. That was the end result instead of a large one-page business plan.
Well, yes, to take a phallocentric view of the study, those estimations are a fair call, but of course women were subject to the same problem, and thus we saw women often take far more time on average to masturbate and potentially have more orgasms, which got in the way of them completing the useful business task.
So women popped more than men, that's what you're saying, and therefore had a greater opportunity cost, can I say that?
I think it's safe to say that I'm pleased you resisted talking about female orgasm like so many other people do in terms of like mild showers or squirt storms. They are not appropriate terms.
Well, I did my research and listened to interviews you've done with other podcasts. I know you've been quite irritated when hosts have used those terms to describe female orgasms. And I know, as much as anyone, that just because it's a female orgasm doesn't mean there's a deluge of fluid. Sometimes it's a simple, fairly dry, intense moment of pleasure.
Indeed.
And the other part of your recent work I find fascinating was that when somehow sexuality did not create popportunity cost of time, it created popportunity cost of quality of work.
Yeah, we found that often people would work towards what seemed to be a useful deadline despite their sexuality potentially getting in the way. Many entrepreneurs, though, get aroused by having ideas themselves that can lead to them immediately masturbating. On the other hand, they want to masturbate over the particular idea they've had at that moment. That's how good they believe the idea is. However, we ended up with sexual pollution of the results. They've reached the deadline, but the results are sexually polluted.
What does that mean?
Well, let's take summer salads, the chain summer salads, you know, summer, like spring, summer, winter. The idea was really solid by the founder, James Antoniak. Have freshly prepared salads assembled to order in front of a customer at a stall or a pop-up stand and offer an alternative to current fast food. However, when he was first devising this, James overcame his inefficiency by minimizing masturbation around his idea. He got a solid business plan. He put a pitch deck together ready. Unfortunately, sex pervaded those early drafts of his business, even though he met the deadlines.
How so?
Well, you know, the devil is in the details, they say. For example, when he drafted the value proposition, he proposed customers could buy the salads at full cost, but there'd be a special membership. They could have a 25% discount if they took all their clothes off.
Right. Irrespective of attractiveness?
He wasn't thinking that deep. He didn't go into that level of detail. Then when we looked at the recommended sauces and dressings to go with the salads, yes, we saw olive oil, French dressing, Thousand Mile dressing, but then he added a number of sauces, all of them with semen as a key condiment.
That would be a difficult sell to those who already appreciate the flavors of vegetables and salads, the natural flavors.
While he did eliminate these gratuitous sexual aspects, by the time the brand launched, he was hiring attractive females to run the stores and favoring young, attractive females as franchisees. I had a more suitable franchisee candidate.
That's not a problem in and of itself, is it? The fact that they're, you know, sort of attractive young females.
Yeah, you're correct in and of itself, whether or not a manager or a franchisee is deemed attractive is not their problem. It's neither here nor there.
Well, that's good to hear. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yes, but it should be nowhere near the dilated pupils of the CEO of Summer Salad. If such franchisees or managers are selected on the basis of physical sexual attractiveness in the eye of the franchisor instead of aptitude, experience, or merit, then sexuality has once again damaged the workplace and the prospects of an otherwise excellent and salient business model.
Now, I want to be clear, because I've read the company values document for Libidno. One of your core values is the non-sex version is always better. What does that mean?
I believe I can imagine a scenario where there is an elimination of the expression of sexuality, and we firmly believe that the version of reality that is non-sex is more expansive and productive, and that's better.
I mean, yeah. Now they say the fish rots from the head. You are asexual, are you? Or are you not?
Yeah, I am asexual, and I take offense to the fish rotting analogy.
Well, it's the name of a famous business book called The Fish Rots from the Head by Rob Garrett about crises in company boardrooms.
Are you sure you didn't just say it because, you know, I'm from Guyana?
No. Why? Is fishing a big industry there or something?
Of course it's a big industry.
If fish makes me think of anything, it's sex, which I, of course, am doing my best not to think about in this podcast. Not doing a good job, but yeah, I'm trying.
Good, because you would contravene our values if you just unilaterally did that.
back to the point. You're asexual in your personal and business life throughout, right?
Yes, I am.
Have you always been asexual? Which is to ask, have you ever had sex?
I'm not a virgin, no. I am a happily married man.
Aha, uh-huh, so you have had sex with your wife, if that's not too personal to ask.
That is a very personal fact, and you're lucky I will answer it for you. No, I do not have sex with my wife.
You, sorry, to reiterate, you don't have sex with your wife.
No, of course not. She's busy with her career.
Wow.
In this way, we are actually a very normal married couple. Lots of married couples are in the same bucket as us.
I suppose that's true. But you have once had sex with your wife, right, at some point?
No, I have not.
What? You've never consummated the marriage.
Isn't it enough that I love my wife, that I courted her, that I expressed my love and devotion to her, that I proposed to her, and I married her? Now I have to consummate the marriage also? How many different ways must society be satisfied that two people love each other and are committed to each other?
I think the answer to that question is 17.
It's not a trick question, Sito.
Okay, still feels like the answer is 17. Anyway, by being asexual yourself, which I admire, are you not perhaps bringing that to bear on a company, on your company, a little too heavily? Which is to say, I see the research, I adore it. Like the pert little number that white paper is.
Inappropriately sexual depiction of a white paper.
Something needs to be done, but do you ever think, I wear my asexuality like chainmail, and I'm potentially fitting a square peg in a round hole by bringing asexuality to another company?
I am asexual, there's no putting anything in any holes.
Have you ever faced real rejection by companies who you've approached about your service on the basis that it's too unrealistically personal belief that you hold, Jimmy Rakan, you hold it, and it's too unrealistic a lifestyle for the greater workforce of that company?
What actually happens is what is realistic. In the early days, we would be called in by human resources to companies with clear sexual harassment track records and clear issues, and a decision maker would reject us. Even though they had all these problems, the decision maker would say, oh, we don't need libido. Yeah, that happened. But you know, I was always clear that this was not merely a B2B offering, company to company. This would always have a B2C element, direct customer, who is the worker themselves. So if the company says no, then there are individuals who work for them who say, yes, we want to be trained by libido.
How did you reach these individuals?
We direct marketed, but often we had inbound marketing interests, sponsors from Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, or a Salah.
Slaw.
Yes, Salah.
Actually, no, it could be pronounced Slayer. I've never thought about that.
They would directly contact us saying, hey, our addiction is affecting work. I must change, and then maybe I can affect change in my co-workers.
A quick break from the riveting discussion with Jamirakan Kanhai of Libidno to profile our sponsor this week. Ever been curious about your lineage and have that yearning desire to find out more about your forebears? Ever wanted to know where your intelligence came from and those great genes that makes your ass look good in great jeans? Well, they must have originated three generations above. Well, there are many websites that can provide that information, but only one will help explain why your mother's eyes are too close together, or why you have a burning desire to sleep with both your older sisters. Incestry.com uses the largest genealogical databases in the world and digs deeper to cut through the familial lies and discover which generation of your family committed incest. Using the Naughty Family trademarked artificial intelligence, Ancestry.com goes further back and looks deeper into potential situations where a playful hand up the dress during coitus wasn't exactly at healthy genetics arm's length. Ancestry.com also provides hints and tips as to how to resist the pull of wanting to get down and dirty with direct family members in the current day. And our new defect hunter helps those of you who absolutely insist on incest to minimize chances of having deformed children. Ancestry.com, because loving thy brother doesn't have to be an ambiguous metaphor. Back to Flog. So what is involved in Libidno offering? Talk me through the B2C offering.
But we are really a service provider first and foremost, and then when people sign up, one of the asexuality advocate contacts them directly. They talk them through the initial 3 months and survey to see which of the therapies will work best with them. But we are really a service provider first and foremost, in that when people sign up, one of our asexuality advocates contacts them directly. They talk them through the initial 3 months of therapy and survey to see which of the therapies will work best with them.
Tell me about these therapies. You have a pharmacological component, I believe, then also a VR, virtual reality component, and other more challenging measures. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, so the medication we use is a proprietary mix of progestogens and anxiolytic, so anxiety-busting medicines.
Progestogens? Compound similar to progesterone? The chemical that's in the mini-pill for women.
So, I mean, this is offered not just to women, but to men? Also to transgender. Stop being so binary, Guan Sital. It can be used by all asexual aspirants.
Asexual aspirants? Is that safe? I mean, is it?
For most, yes. For a minority, perhaps not. We have our company doctor weigh in before anybody takes these.
I believe taking progesterone is a depot injection, or tablets of progesterone. They've been used throughout the world over time as chemical castration. For example, sex offenders have used progesterone tablets as a condition of legal sentencing in some countries. Would it not alarm potential clients to know that they are effectively being chemically castrated once they undergo libidinous therapy?
I disagree with the premise and terminology. Chemical castration is an outdated term, like calling women broads. You know, it's not the 50s. It's not West Side Story. If you're drinking too much and therefore cannot sleep with your sexual partner, I mean, do you say that you've been part of alcoholic emasculation?
Possibly, depending on how intentionally she has filled up my glass. I'd call that alcoholic emasculation. I know this game, and I'm onto it. Not everyone is.
I think our clients would be reassured to know that if dangerous sexualities like that of sex offenders can be curbed by this treatment, then their sexuality suppression is in the safest of hands.
The safest of suppressive hands?
Consenting safe hands that gently ease the libido away.
Hands shouldn't ease a libido, they should please a libido.
This sounds exactly like what a sexually harassing boss would say to an intern. Probably a boss who also thinks he can rap.
What other techniques are there for those who cannot do the tablets?
We have instructional videos available for all, both on YouTube, but more productively in a virtual reality format. That is to say, we give a personnel the option to virtually experience what it is to be on all sides of the sexuality spectrum. If we have a male client, we can offer a VR scenario where he is a female employee at the same workplace who in one scenario is flirted with appropriately, in another VR scenario is touched inappropriately, and in advanced scenarios is very confronting, she or he being a she is actively assaulted.
God, does that work? To encourage asexual behavior, that is?
It is really the part of our process which has the highest research rating and which is the core of our intellectual property at Libidno. We lease these VR experiences to governments and prison systems looking to reform sex offenders as much as we give it to those seeking asexuality in a workplace.
This may say something about the people I've met. The company you keep, well, the people I've met, I'll agree with. Look, what I wanted to say is, this may say something about them, that seeing a VR no-consequence sexual harassment scenario may just be what some men especially, but perhaps some women, want by way of sexual fantasy material to, you know, get their kicks with. They would seek that out as an enjoyable sexual experience. You know, getting harassed in a VR scenario, or God forbid assaulted, that's for them, you know, just darkly enjoyable sexual experience. according to their values. And as they're not harming real people by going through that process, I think that they'd feel okay about it. And, you know, that's quite contrary to your intention with that technology. Now, my minor research into artificial intelligence and virtual reality having a soul, having a conscience, as well as a consciousness. Ooh, that's an edgy opinion. Let's put that to the side. We have a policy to put any bizarre, inappropriate sexual behavior on record, which the employer, if they pay for the service, immediately accesses, but which they can reasonably ask for, even if the employee is paying directly for the service. The employer can reasonably ask for that, which is to say, you do not want to play around inappropriately with the virtual reality, or you will be listed as a virtual potential sex offender. Really? Yes, if people don't like this, we say don't use the service. But a time will come where if you have not used libido, if you have not done the basic training of the service, employers in certain sectors or leading employers or your workmates, they may ask, why not? Why has this person not done this training? Your growth is dramatic, so I would normally contest the claim you just made. You're close. Your growth is exponentially high. See, you might be right. In a couple of years, it's going to be demanded that libido training has occurred in a company. That's just going to be the tolerance point.
No, I agree with you. The desire for work to be a safe place for this sad and frightened history. Both history of sexuality is diverting the assiduousness of so many good people in the workforce. This collective dissipation of desire is something I feel here in my heart, because the dissipation of desire enables people to move forward.
God, that was kind of moving. So if the tablets don't work, if the VR simulation becomes not a deterrent or any sort of positive training, but you have someone whose sexuality hasn't impacted the work or co-workers or the company reputation, someone who wants to pass and become asexual but cannot get there through your core means, the VR and the tablets, do they have another option to say libid no? Did you like that?
That was good. Of course, there are other options. There are herbal and homeopathic supplements we can provide that they may be able to tolerate. And we have a role called the safe steward, who will directly coach them away from any sexualized approach to work.
The safe steward.
Yes, these are our best asexual trainers who will work through world-class cutting-edge teachings and case studies to desexualize these trickier workers.
Why is asexuality essential in the workplace? I understand the need to eliminate, and I do mean eliminate, not just minimize sexual harassment, sexually intimidating behavior, inappropriate sexual language, and gender-based suppression, let alone sexual assault. That's intolerable. But many couples meet through work. Many healthy sexual relationships which progress to life partnership or marriage occur between people within the same organization or company. Asexuality to me implies a negation of these sorts of healthy relationships. Don't these become a casualty of your company's approach?
They do. But our core values and mission are such that we have to have a trade-off. We don't aim to please everyone, nor focus on what structures may have been generated in the past. I think in a world of 7.8 billion people, where we can potentially find so incredibly many diverse choices of life partner or sexual partner that are well suited to have a sexual intimate relationship with, which may or may not lead to, you know, long-term life or part-life partnership, it blows my mind that people could be so unimaginative to date or marry someone sitting right next to them at the cubicle next to them, or who works in the same department that they see at the water cooler. Yes, spending lots of waking hours working towards the same goals as another person that you're attracted to, that you see every day, that increases the odds of forming a relationship. I acknowledge that. But, what a lazy notion. Here we are, human beings capable of travel, capable of making ourselves happy or sad, or creating superconductors or going into outer space. And instead we use proximity to dictate who we have sexual activity with and build our life with. I mean, come on.
Speaking of proximity with a strange snobbishness, it really dictates a lot of why people live lives the way they do. It's why people never leave the town that they're born in. I feel it's a little scornful of the socioeconomics of it. You know, if you live in a small town, you go to the nearest school, you shop at the local shops. If you can afford it, you go elsewhere, perhaps. But you might not be able to. And people may not think of an elsewhere, you know, a better place. Personalities are built differently, and imagination may not feature heavily in these people, but practicality does.
Using your logic, why wouldn't we eat our own shit instead of other food? We emit it regularly, shit, and it's in our body, and, you know, it regularly comes out. Why not just eat it?
It has no nutritional value. This is a terrible example. It's not practical and causes displeasure. It's a bad analogy.
Much of the food people can imaginatively select... Much of the food people can imaginatively select also has limited or no nutritional value. Why drink the zero-calorie cola drink I see on your desk?
I feel there's an inherent flaw in using shit and food to discuss workplace relationships successfully. So that's my mistake. What data and analysis do you have to substantiate the value of asexuality in the workplace for those who don't just want to be asexual completely? I mean, surely that's an option, that you don't just become completely asexual, you're just asexual for the purposes of work. I guess I should ask this.
Of course there's an option. We would only be a niche company if we catered to people who just didn't want any sexually whatsoever. Although that percentage of society is increasing, let me tell you.
How? Not through the usual forms of reproduction?
You just butterfly that as part of the growth. Genes for asexuality are more prominently being phenotypically expressed. But let me speak to the way our therapy works and an acquisition we made. So I spoke about the supplements in a subscription box that we send out to the new clients of Libidna. Now, let's say you have 4 weeks leave upcoming. We recommend ceasing or tapering down the tablets 1 week leading into the holiday period.
Interesting. That brings back natural libido in men and women. Is that why you do it?
Yes. Now, we have a supplemental pad that would promote sex drive for those who want it. Actively promote it with, you know, androgens. But it's not essential. Now, in early trials of holiday periods, we look to people to find their own footing, to know what it is to go back to the old normal for sexuality, be they singles or married or coupled otherwise.
So if you have Jaginda and Jill coming into the holiday period,
who's Jaginda and Jill?
We can't say Jack and Jill, there's not enough diversity in that. So Jaginda and Jill coming into the holiday period, we're counting on them getting back to the activities and atmosphere that got them together in the first place. Is that what you're saying? They go on holiday, that magic, you know, erotic frissons return.
Yeah, we were expecting that would be rediscovered and that would, by contrast, make the holidays that little bit more special, right? However, we found that in the spirit of habits taken 30 days to form, that this couple, they were out of practice. And in fact, what made people leave as clients of Libidna was hitting the holiday period and realizing that sexuality had gone AWOL, like permanently AWOL.
The sexuality was a missing person on the side of a milk carton.
I think it is better to say their sexuality chose to live on the fringes. What you suggested is their sexuality has been kidnapped, which is not how we look at it.
Well, it sounds as if it has. These poor workers go off the stuff and hope it returns, and it doesn't.
Everyone's kidnapped. Where's the ransom note? Where are the kidnappers' demands? Again, a bad analogy by you, and not the first time I've faced a kidnapper analogy. I sued Inc. magazine for likening the loss of libido on a client as a kidnapping, and the magazine wanted to apologize, but I kept with the slander lawsuit till we won because I do not negotiate with terrorists or kidnappers.
Right. So you made an acquisition. You bought the company Romantic Cheat Meals, which, for the benefit of listeners, took the idea of the cheat meal in fitness training, whereby for 20 meals a week, someone trying to meet weight goals will eat clean or rigorously controlled in their diet. They'll be rigorously controlled. But then they'll have a 21st meal in a week, that one meal in contrast to the controlled meals, in which the person can eat whatever they want. Foods like ice cream and pizza and ribs, which hit the pleasure senses. The theory being that such a meal shocks the body out of a slowing metabolism and a starvation mindset, which you know, people often get into when they severely diet and train, and also makes the overall dietary fitness plan more sustainable.
Yeah, Lilith Fregar, who you know, is the trainer that that created romantic cheat meals, should have let using this mentality of cheat meals to a long-term relationship prove to have tremendous success. She had incredible positive feedback by taking off on unhappy couples who felt chained to each other or who had already been hurt by infidelity, who are faithful out of loyalty but miserable within the marriage. And she proposed a cheat meal once per week whereby each spouse could spend time intimately with someone else. Yeah, so once a week, treat affair. Not really an affair. It could be if the same person was sort out for the cheat meal. But, you know, in principle, yes. I really like the model because it embraced realism about marriage and it took a bold approach to keeping marriages together while celebrating sexuality in a very healthy way. So libidina trained clients are immediately subscribed to this network, a dating network really, and your whole service, which trains asexuality, all of a sudden, counterintuitively pushes people to extramarital intimacy, quite a bit of sexuality. You can see why your critics raise an eyebrow to that, surely. I mean, what do you stand for is the question they ask.
Sita, the cheat meal acquisition helped solidify our market position so well. We could say to all our critics, we respect sexuality to your point, Jason, just not in respect to the workplace or work. You know, Larry Ellison at Oracle did not want to use us. The minute we acquired the cheat day company, he rolls out our service across his entire organization.
Well, even that stuns me. I mean, Larry, of course, famous for his real estate deal and his marriages to stunning young women, and the thought that he would go asexual at work, I mean, previously I would have just thought that unthinkable, even with the permissive presence of cheat date.
Well, we did a rollout at Uber, famous for its cultural problems around sexual harassment, that is pretty well known. The board was so confident that they challenged us to work with a former CEO, Travis Kalanick, to rehabilitate his public business image, and he was keen to be rehabilitated himself towards a libidina asexuality at work.
Really? Wow! You're working on Travis Kalanick, who turned a blind eye to sexual harassment allegations and has complaints against him for using prostitutes while in a work capacity, and had to resign accordingly.
I'm telling you, we have achieved the flywheel effect that Jim Collins speaks about in his book Good to Great. You know, we are really scaling effectively because this core philosophy is a universally needed executable idea that we have about asexuality in the workplace.
I mean, you're not wrong. I'm in awe of what you've been able to achieve, Jamira Khan. Honestly, I'm in awe.
But I wonder, you know, I still see some skepticism. If you still owned your pharmacy group, Cital, if you would make the switch to a libidina-approved workplace?
It's an interesting question. So, you know, I love what you stand for. I think not every company that appears on this show has noble intentions and impressive efficacy. I have to say, though, that I'm not sure I in my company would have had libidina.
You are a $51 million company at your peak. You had 10 plus sites across the country and over 500 team members. I had done my research. You surely cannot say you did not have some problematic situations where sexuality caused distress for even one team member.
Oh, I know of at least one case of sexual harassment that personally disgusted and distressed me. An after-school 18-year-old casual was kept after hours by an assistant manager at one of our Sydney stores and sexually abused. It was awful. It was bloody awful. Firing that scumbag was the least forthright action. I mean, put me in a room with him on our own and other stuff would have happened. So no amount of empathy or counselling is going to make right what happened to that girl. You know, we're still in touch to this day, and it's hard for her.
Now, how can you show hesitancy in wanting the libidina way to have been integrated into your organization? This is an academic discussion, of course. I'm not trying to go back in time to implement our service, but your reluctance, I gotta know what drives it.
Humor me. I don't always find it very fun running my company. turning up every day to deal with big, difficult, mercurial personalities. It wore me down so much that for all the skills I gained and then flexed owning and running pharmacies, my heart isn't in it anymore, and I don't think it ever will be. And sometimes, dear Jamira Khan, sometimes I wouldn't hiring, if I'm honest with myself, choose to hire a woman so aesthetically pleasing and with whom I had such incredible chemistry in the interview or through the recruitment process that would lift me up to see and talk to her whenever I could and to know that I got to work with her. I could have chosen another candidate for some of the roles. Sure, I could. I can't say with all libido aside, with all sexuality removed, that I chose the best person possible for the job. Sometimes the cheekbones got the managerial position, not the best candidate. Sometimes luminous skin and a constellation of freckles and glorious felt height and a twinkle in her eye got a girl a contract and a chance at a position or experience level would otherwise not have allowed her to get to. I never harassed any of my team members. Not to my knowledge. Not that they ever told me or that I was aware of or anyone else made me aware of. Still, that flirting that Elle and I did around my birthday when she and two members of the team took me out for drinks the year after we'd almost been wiped out by the GFC, I'll never forget that evening. The pining I did for that brunette fox who ran one of my dispensaries all through the year my business partnership was about to collapse. She kept me going. When that blue-eyed sales girl got poached by one of my competitors for twice the salary, I was just thrilled and jealous of other men we get to see her be magical, selling skincare on the store floor. So you see Jamira Khan in a world of asexuality at work. And don't get me wrong, I'm not against asexuality. In fact, I think it solves a lot of problems. In my failed romantic life, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't wish I was programmed to never feel a flutter when I see a pretty girl, from the money I would have saved alone. But in a version of my company where we're all neutered safely by libido, well, I think one day I'd have gone home in that scenario and made sure I didn't get out of bed. And that's just me being honest. That was a moving speech, my friend. I almost saw your point of view, and I do not say that scornfully, I say it humbly, with recognition of the affection and ambivalence you had for the company that you built, for what it is to work and what gets you through the day. Nonetheless, while I am not psychic, I am well-researched in speaking to founders like yourself time and time again, and they say to me that libido is what helped them make their company grow. In a pitch session, libido helped them dazzle in the show. You see, libido, the drive, helps them survive. It sustains libido, the anodyne liar, cause it causes the pain. You revel at the sales girl who got pushed from your store, but if you got hired someone else, it would have got you so much more. Your company has wound up defunct, no longer flowing. Without libido, the choices you'd have made that have truly kept you going. It'll be a company of $100 million, just like you dreamed, instead of talking to me here. It'd be your talk I'd have streamed. I'd have made this company for the greater good. Might look like a drag, but a better business world we all adore is my BHAG. So you romanticize libido, and rather than feed the bleeding narrative, I tell you why it has to go. For libido gone, the girl who feels she has to show her cleavage to get the job or the raise doesn't need to even think it's something she should try. With libido gone, the gay worker who feels he must hide who he is while his peers talk about their conquests, and the girl at the front desk that they all want to shag doesn't have to. That gay man, he doesn't have to worry about being alienated because everyone has put their libido aside and there's no need for shame. With libido gone, the girl you hired doesn't have to feel uncomfortable and indebted as her mentor flirts with her. With libido gone, women at the beginning of their careers don't have to pay their dues with being hit on and groped and jaded. With libido gone, the divorcee manager doesn't get seduced and played by his two IC so she can climb the corporate ladder. Careers don't need to end. Families don't need to be fractured. Individuals don't need to face anguish and turmoil in the shadow of the company. With libido gone, there is no couple having a little death of orgasm in the work bathroom.
that work liaison don't come to regret. With libido gone, there'll be no larger deaths at the most precious team member wishes the only job she or he or they or it had to give their best to was the one they applied for. Not a blowjob, not a hand job, not any of the other jobs. Just the job they applied for.
Wow. Okay. As convincing as that was, oh wow, I'm not gonna lie. As convincing as that was, we are being honest, so just speak your truth. You're sure? Of course. That was so good. I'm kind of aroused.
I see.